This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Mira Sivasudi. Now after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the Bigger Pictures Health and Living to you, live, on the ground. A whole day with the experts, debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, addressing our love affair with food, and of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharat, we're going to talk about impotence.
Since it's not the medical show, I'm assuming it's some other kind of impotence, like social, political, cultural, psychological. What kind of impotence are we talking about? What?
It's a mix of those. Definitely not medical, but a mix of social and psychological. And I want to particularly focus on what Freud calls psychical impotence. This is an impotence where the person is divided in the sense that he cannot unite his desire and his love.
Oh, his desire and love.
Correct.
Okay.
But split. So he can have sex with somebody he desires, but cannot do so with somebody he loves.
Is this a problem that he encountered in his kind of clinical work? Or?
Correct. And particularly if we're going to ground it in a text, the main text would be the one called On the Universal Tendency to Debasement in the Sphere of Love. So he believes it's universal. In fact, he begins his account of this in his essay saying that this is something that him and other clinical psychoanalysts encountered. And he even ventured to say that this is actually very widely unacknowledged, that people should be talking about this. So it flies against the face of the ideal that we have where love and sexual desire somehow finds a neat convergence. For Freud, it's often more than not the case that they are split and almost impossible to reconcile.
Okay, so perhaps it's the question of definition that, or definition imposed by, you know, society or culture at that time that conflated desire, sexual, activity, love and marriage, you know, all of them, all these things come together and
correct,
are expected only to work, as it were, within that, right? So
correct,
there are many societies in which one should not or cannot or not allowed to have sex outside of marriage. That mm-hmm. union delimits mm-hmm. the space for anything like sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe beyond that desire, but then it's kind of has to be somehow sublimated in some
correct
form, right? It,
mm-hmm.
it cannot seem to be that which it is. So, you know, maybe it's a question of definition, maybe, or a kind of cultural expectation that was in fact misplaced.
I think you're right. There are cases where certain cultures, certain contexts are quite aware that desire, sexual desire and love are two different things and they shouldn't be expected to converge in one person. It's the idea that one person can embody the two goals of emotional and psychological fulfillment, right?
And also that it should carry on over time. I mean, we might be ourselves, working from specific cultural norms, because there might be societies, of course, and, you know, having studied anthropology, you know that there are many societies mm-hmm. in which these unions could be quite fluid.
Mm-hmm.
It really has to do with certain kinship systems.
Correct.
And that will also change the configuration of these things, love and desire.
Correct.
Both of which, in terms of definitions, love and desire, I mean, what is love but the desire for others, and what is desire mm-hmm. but love?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. How would you begin to define those?
What Freud has in mind is sexual desire. Broadly speaking, erotic impulses, sexual energy, sensual instinct, the idea that the body requires pleasure as part of its fuller nourishment. So that's what he has in mind when he talks about desire. Love, he believes, is related to the pre-Oedipal context. Preservation of life, tactile embrace, the security afforded by caregivers, That's what he really means by love. So it's very physiological in many ways. Even love takes a very physiological bent. He acknowledges that some of the more philosophical flourishes around talk of love is really a later kind of result of culture. But fundamentally, you have this split between the caregiving, tactile experience of, you know, what he's going to identify as motherhood, and of course the erotic part that's more avaricious and salacious and racy. So he believes that there's a fundamental split that we all struggle with. By we, he means heterosexual males. Now, we should note that Freud was working with a particular demographic. He's talking about a very Victorian bourgeoisie of the Vienna that he was most actively researching in. But this bourgeois form of family is going to be in many ways exported through capital and stuff like that. But key to why this essay is still read today is because it explains why men, heterosexual men in particular, must debase their sexual partners. Masculinity depends on a certain relationship with a female sexual partner that entails degradation.
Two things. One is the t-shirt you're wearing has Freud as a stuffed toy or a bear.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I'm going to leave that aside because perhaps we need a good one or two sessions of therapy for you to get to explain why you're wearing such a t-shirt. But Fuad, I'll put that aside.
Listeners, that was incidental, by the way.
But okay,
purely,
never mind.
Unplanned,
you know? Yeah. And you'll be able to see this in the photograph we take for the podcast. So you'll see this t-shirt. I think it's fascinating. The other thing, I guess, is the fact that you're kind of limiting it to the question of heterosexual males, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's very interesting because you already have beyond these, you know, the psychosexual dynamic, you also have cultural norms about the relative, the hierarchies in which men and women, are positioned, mm-hmm. right? And social hierarchies mm-hmm. that men and women are positioned,
correct.
Which already, I guess, in those society, in the society that Freud comes from, women would, I'm presuming, would have been disadvantaged.
Relatively disadvantaged. And somebody like Praveen Adams, you know, a more contemporary psychoanalyst, would say that what they were going through was essentially an experience with the modern form of patriarchy, right? Expectations upon women to behave a certain way, for them to negotiate a new public sphere. I mean, it's a very contesting time with social changes and, you know, capitalism forming and stuff like that. So in addition to that, in addition to the degradation of women, I'll probably explain his train of thought later, how Freud processed this into distinct arguments. Freud also believes that this explains why a lot of marriages fail, essentially. When the initial excitement of forbidden sex that's dismantled through marriage, when that excitement is over, the male, he believes, will no longer feel sexually attracted to the wife and will go on to find a different partner who can fulfill his lust. And there's a typical way that society tries to explain this. It says that, you know, the man is bored, or the man no longer prizes the woman because she's no longer forbidden, and so on and so forth. But Freud's answer is that when a woman becomes the subject or the object of love, she can no longer be the object of desire.
So it's not a bad thing. So the woman goes from being object of desire at the initial stage,
correct.
And becomes an object of love.
Correct.
Which is, I mean, I don't know if I'm correct, but is that an exalted position? Is that position higher than being an object desired?
For Freud, there is this esteem, a newfound esteem, that will accompany the woman in her transition from being the object of forbidden sex to the object of love, to the caregiver role that she will eventually take as a domestic manager or, you know, a housewife or a wife, a caregiver, the family and all that.
Before, just very recently, I was on Twitter and there was a tweet from, I bet she's a celebrity of some sort, and she's recently married, and in it, she says something to the effect that, oh, I do not ever leave the house without my husband's permission. And I kind of like said, oh, is that the new ideal for womanhood in Malaysia, that one must always seek the permission of the male, that you know that, because this is being put out in the public sphere. So there's a very interesting thing, right? On one hand, it's a very sort of you are saying you must be confined to the domestic sphere, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and the only person who can let you out mm-hmm. is your husband. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're tweeting it out to gazillions of people in what is the public sphere, displaying your voice, doing quite the opposite of what your said intention is. But it seems to be a really conflicted kind of impulse Correct. Today among some women to want to debase themselves, want to show themselves to be, not debase in this, mm-hmm. in the Freudian sense, but, subordinate and subservient.
Yeah. And Freud laments this. He believes that, because this is the case, the nuclear heterosexual family, the only way it can function is if it really succumbs to the implicit patriarchy, that's at work. So he doesn't really believe that in a heterosexual nuclear setup, you can actually have healthy synergy in relation to desire and love. One has to make way for another,
But does the man, within the Viennese society that Freud was exploring, was he allowed to then leave his wife and, project his sexual desires onto other women? Surely, those kinds of extramarital things would have been frowned upon, at least formally, by the church.
It was happening in secret. And Freud writes about that in the essay. This is the common thing that he hears of in his circles, that men who acquire, beautiful, well-to-do women can nonetheless feel that their desire isn't fulfilled, despite the ostensible fact that she's the complete package or whatever. So there's always that residue desire that somehow finds a very incompatible connection with love. Yeah.
So the problem is this, or maybe there is no problem. If men are then, society moves and says, you can have your external liaisons, so you can have your sexual desire, and you can also have your dutiful, deferential wife, and you are also dutiful, right? As a man, you're dutiful. You're a good father. You're a good husband to the extent that you provide. Would that normality? Is that the compromise?
That wouldn't resolve it either, because the man will be constantly split. There's an essential component to his way of relating to the world, to his way of feeling, that cannot be reconciled. Because where there is love, there is no desire. And where desire, there is no love. And this is quite difficult for most men, at least of Freud's time, to really juggle. Now, while this is very standard and bourgeois, the context that he's referring to, you have more contemporary readings of the essay that tries to locate this even in non-heterosexual relationships. So while there are many of these contextual considerations, the impulse that sees a very essential divergence between love and desire is where this essay is seen to be still useful. But let's touch on the particular arguments in the second part of the show. We're going to see Freud's logic. Why would anyone think this? And why would anyone think this is inevitable? And why would we want to believe him even? And we'll save that for the second part of the show. And we'll take a break for a minute. This is Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutin, as always. And you're listening to BFM 89.9.
You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April. Find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School, and I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutin, and we're discussing psychical impotence via the theory proposed by Freud. And in the first half of the show, we sketched the issue, what the problems are, and essentially it's an incompatibility between desire and love, right? Where many people can't love the people they're having exciting sex with and can't have exciting sex with the people they're in love with.
So where's the impotence? In fact, in many ways, the word impotence hasn't emerged. So, we're putting aside the medical question question of, being, impotent in a medical sense. But what is it? You're saying that men, if I if I understand correctly, don't like the split. I mean, I can see how some men might like the split and think this is a perfect situation, right? You just love the person you love and then you have sex, the greatest sex you can with somebody you don't necessarily love and who goes away once sex is over. But I actually wanted to ask a much more kind of like personal question. I mean, intellectually, do you think an essay like this speaks to contemporary Malaysian society?
I think so, insofar as Malaysian society is defined by many of the bourgeois social patterns that Freud saw. A strong emphasis on family values, the idea of families as a core of society, core of the economy as well. Newly encountered questions on freedom, autonomy, the idea of happiness, right? It's taken center stage where the idea that you are an individual entitled to certain privileges, benefits, and affirmation in the world, right? So these things were, in many ways, circulating in the discourses that Freud encountered as well.
That list is interesting because I think with each of those items, you want to add the autonomy of the heterosexual male, you know, and the because with women, it might not be autonomy. It might, in fact, be dependence, that the women are increasingly defined, or, well, maybe we had a period where there was much more freedom for women, but now increasingly defined as not autonomous. And then the example, the tweet I gave earlier, but seek to be subservient or dependent on the male. So it's male autonomy that's center stage and a female dependence that kind of like completes the man, right?
Yeah, in the context of, I guess, what is taken to be conventional heterosexual arrangements, and although the key thing that I think connects a lot of bourgeois settings is that the women are located in ambivalent spaces, right? There is strong, compelling discourses calling for greater liberties, but at the same time, a strong pushback as well.
Yeah, you think of, in fact, all the social and economic arrangements that allow for female autonomy as one of those impediments to the imposition of this ideal of female subservience, right?
Correct.
Because women can have jobs, women can drive cars, women can set up homes independently of men. There are no, in fact, real material constraints on women are doing these things, especially in urban settings in Malaysia.
I would agree, yeah.
So where do we go from now? Okay, so you're saying that that the reason for being interested in this essay is that it does, in fact, speak to a contemporary situation so far as those bourgeois norms are, you know, upheld as well.
But I think a more specific way to put this would be to say that I think, in general, that claim is true. By now, I know many friends who are struggling with relationship, heterosexual male friends, and they always have this split between the woman they love, who they go to be cared for, to be protected, to feel recognized, and the woman that they don't really regard in any romantic sense, but have strong sexual desires that are very degrading and in some ways, one would say, unconventional in terms of the kinds of things that they like, which, you know, one could safely say are debasing.
I know you're struggling to find the word. I'm thinking it was like kinky and, but okay, but beyond that. So again, impotence, we come back to the word impotence we don't use enough of. I hear guilt. I hear this, men are guilty because they can love women, but when they love a woman, they can't really have great sex with her. Or if they have great sex with her, they can't really love her. Okay, so that's guilt. But impotence suggests a lack of power, right? An inability to perform something. And what is that inability? What is that that can't be performed?
They can't perform with the woman they love. Freud refers to marriage, but he also makes allusions to general heterosexual coitus, you know, and he encounters that the deeper connection that a man would foster towards a woman that would be called love somehow cannot the same level of sexual enthusiasm. And he writes this quite clearly. He says that the man, in order to do this, would have to imagine a different woman or would have to tell himself something else other than sex being the reason. And this is very agonizing, he believes, that a man will have to be put in this position and it will affect the relationship in one way or another. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Although, like he even says himself, it's not widely discussed because society has upheld this norm where love and sex are supposed to be one. Whereas what he believes is that what he sees is that it's very difficult for men to find that. Yeah.
So is it possible within the framework that he sets out to reconcile these two things, love and sexual desire?
In very few cases, people don't have this problem. And I'll explain how soon when we get to the particulars of his argument. Yeah.
So maybe you can set up the argument.
All right, sure. So the argument is this, and we've done Freud many times in this show, but I'll kind of fast forward it to the Oedipal moment. So before the Oedipal moment, you have to imagine an infant male child who's very much sheltered, taken care of by a caregiver. The caregiver is typically a woman. And this caregiver, Freud will label as the mother. And this process is very embodied. Yeah, human beings being very vulnerable to nature have to be conditioned to transition from nature to culture, right? You must acquire language. You must be able to be toilet trained. You must be able to be clothed. And this is a process that is guided by a caregiving figure. Now, in this physical process, two things happen. The child realizes his dependency on the mother, on shelter and self, and the preservation of life. But the child also is stimulated, right? So the child, in feeling the world, wants joy, wants to play, wants to do whatever it wants. The child doesn't want to explain anything. The child can defecate on the floor and still be cared for. The child can pee wherever and still be loved. The child can have very dirty, so-called uncivilized pleasures without having to answer for it. Okay, this is a very important point that's going to lead to the future development of the boy.
I see where this is going. Okay. And so, that's true, though. I mean, but you do get spanked. I mean, it's not that the child does not encounter censure. They do, right? I mean, I'm talking about most children, right?
Definitely. And there are some reasons why some men find spanking and censuring sensual. Because it's very embedded in that process of feeling the world. The child coming to the world and feeling it. Imagine feeling the world for the first time without self-consciousness, without the defensiveness of your thought process, right? It's overwhelming, a lot of pleasure, a lot of terror too. But what happens to the terror? Terror is shielded by the caregiver.
Okay, so your mother will censure you and spank you, but her love is unconditional and eternal, it
correct,
seems.
Correct.
And it's in the experience of the child, right?
Yes, yes. Unbeknownst to the child, that the eternity will be curtailed by the
adulthood,
adulthood by life. It is at this point that Freud locates the split between desire and love. What happens as the infant reaches 3 or 4? Actually, earlier, but 3 or 4 is when it gets crystallized into consciousness. The father enters the picture. The father is not just another physical presence. The father represents authority, morality, but more than that, the end of the pleasure the child had up to that point indulged in.
Right, the uninhibited pleasures.
Correct.
Right, okay.
And Freud is going to call this castration. Yeah.
Oh, but not literal castration.
It's not literal castration. Okay. Yeah.
So this is a kind of psychic castration.
Correct.
Okay.
At that point, the child can no longer relate to the mother in the form of unbounded pleasure that he could before. This is where the incest taboo comes in. Once the incest taboo comes in, the child can only turn to the mother for protection and preservation, no longer sexual pleasure. Yeah.
And sexual here is a much broader category than, say, coitus, right?
Correct.
So we mean by sexual pleasure just a kind of desiring eros.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
But it's not.
It's not coitus. No.
Yeah, not coitus. Okay.
That's why in kinky sex, it's really just coitus. It's, you know, talking dirty. It's all those things, right? So at this point, any child going through the normal process, ideally, would suspend all these needs and find sex and desire unified in his wife. But 99% of the time, this doesn't happen. Most boys have to repress the sexual pleasure they had with the mother and only turn to the mother for preservation and love and the caregiving experience. And the residue, strong residue sexual impulses, have to find escapes in different ways. Now, Freud is going to say first that this escape is rarely normal. It's usually neurotic, yeah, because you're having this split.
Right. So when you say neurotic, it's like guilt-ridden or...
Guilt-ridden, like... contradictory. Powerful, compelling contradictions. The pleasure feels compelling, but the wrongness of it all also feels compelling. And you're just oscillating like a pendulum between one and the other.
Because you can't give up the pleasures either, right?
Correct, correct. Mm-hmm. So this, obviously, culture doesn't talk about it. The boy evolves. The boy grows up. And eventually, this will have to meet with an adult form, this kind of, you know, residue inhibited pleasure. And it's to that poor adult recipient of that residual repressed pleasure that his desire will be channeled.
Just to complete the picture, why isn't the girl child in the similar position?
Okay, so this is a major criticism against Freud, in the sense that because he wanted his framework to fit in the evolutionary program, he would pay more, in fact, one would say, exaggerated attention to the male for being the kind of mover of the procreation process. But Bruce Fink, the Lacanian and contemporary psychoanalyst, would have a different reading, and he would apply the same process to the female child. But maybe more on that later. But for now, let's trace the steps. No longer in the sanctuary of the mother, the boy is now split, loves the mother, cannot channel sexual energy. The boy marries, right? And even though the boy marries out of sex initially, if the wife transforms into the caregiving mother material, he will not be able to channel his sexual energy to that figure, because for the longest time, he had repressed it.
So the boy child learns never to associate the caregiving or the nurturing figure of the mother or any substitute for mother as being an appropriate object for desire.
Correct. You cannot sexually desire the person who nourishes you.
Can't you unlearn these things?
No, because Freud has been so repressed, and because the terror of the incest taboo is so powerful, you cannot challenge it. It just stays in your head.
So when you say incest taboo, in this case, it's as a boy child, you cannot have sexual desire for your mother, or at least you cannot make realize that sexual desire, right? So that's what the incest... Okay.
So there is this tension that the heterosexual male will encounter, in the sense that for desire to be properly released, some form of debasement is needed.
This opens up a huge field, because we know that, at least in, you know, Western culture, at least contemporary culture, there's a couple of hundred years, we've been exploring the question of debasement, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's there in the Marquis de Sade, it's there everywhere now. There's recognition of, there's this dark, I mean, we can sometimes call it a dark side, but mm-hmm. there's this other side of desire, which perhaps refuses to recognize that object of desire in loving terms, maybe, you know?
Yeah. And I find this a very curious answer to that. Why is it that we must have this split? And Bruce Fink, drawing on the same essay, he's going to say, well, just look at how society would classify, in general, women. You have mother nature, the motherland, you know, you have motherhood described in very grand terms as authoritative, but perennial and larger than any of us physically. But then you also have, you know, the wild woman who cannot be tamed and
the
stuff
slut,
like that.
The whore
and the slut. There are these very strong contrasting ideas of women that somehow float in society. Both somehow equally prominent in the dominant imagination, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's some comedy around this as well. The idea that, you know, in the kitchen, your wife ought to be your mother, and in the bedroom, she's got to be some kinky whore. I mean, it's a stereotype, and a stereotype that gives a kind of, at least among men, heterosexual men, the titillation is there, right? It's because it, correct. I get it, you know.
Yeah.
This is, of course, completely you know, reduces women to objects, correct, right? Objects of the male gaze and male desire.
But do you think that this model can work in the kind of non-heterosexual patriarchal mold that, that Freud is describing?
Yeah, certainly. I think that especially when it comes to questions of repression and early repression and your attitudes to what's transgressive and what's not transgressive, non-heterosexual modes of desiring also get configured in various ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we'd need to go to a theorist to see how they work mm-hmm. those things out. But sure, I mean, the non-heterosexual world is not, untouched by, I think, the early kind of relationships, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. You have with your mother, with your father, and what is permissible and what is not permissible, what is considered dirty, and how, as you put, paradoxically, what is dirty then also and not allowed mm-hmm. becomes desirable. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. forbidden fruit is desirable, and we have ways in our language to describe precisely maybe it doesn't come quite to where what you're talking about, but it, to some extent, right? Because forbidden fruit is, in fact, desirable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we are in ambivalent relationships to things that we know we shouldn't do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and we're caught in that. So I think everybody is susceptible to those kinds of dynamics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you have to work out the specifics for non-heterosexual relationships.
And there are many criticisms of Freud. And maybe one day we should do that, like critiques of Freud, because we've done so much of Freud already. So
no, but it's important. He's important because he opens up the field.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
And, you know... And in fact, that's how I think intellectual life proceeds, right? Mm-hmm. You have somebody who opens up the field, as Marx correct. Did, and then you have all these internal critiques mm-hmm. and correctives, and you know, we look at gaps and we fill them, and that's the richness of intellectual life. It's not because somebody revealed knowledge to us; it's because knowledge is an endless process of, you know, critique and advancement, isn't it?
I agree. And just to footnote that there are many different theories of desire, but it's interesting that this article from 1912 is still being referenced when we talk about this split, you know, love and sex. Right. In any case...
Recommendations.
So I really recommend this piece. I mean, it's not long at all, and Freud writes very directly. There's almost no stylistic flourish in this. It's called On the Universal Tendency to Debasement in the Sphere of Love. And you can just... Google that, many PDF versions will be out, and you know, enjoy, and hopefully you learn a few things about yourself along the way.
Yeah. Also, I think movies are interesting, and I would recommend female or women directors in this regard. There's a name of a director I can't quite remember at this point. It's a French director, and she has a film called Sa Sœur, I think it's My Sister, but the English title is often rendered as Fat Girl. Hmm. And it's about this young girl who watches her sister in a relationship with a young man, and how her own sexual desires are shaped and built through this act of observing this, you know, kind of heterosexual relationship, very early sexual relationship. And I think you see it with a lot of women directors. I think of my mother's own work, you know, as somebody who wrote poetry, constantly trying to figure out, but from a woman's point of view, the meaning of desire and love and sex.
And for the record, what's her name?
Oh, my mother's name. I can tell you, I actually know that. It's Rosalie Puticherry. Okay. Her first novel is really about her own life and the men in her life.
Can we find out a bit about your Oedipal process from her novels?
Yes, one of these days. I think it would be a special edition of Night School, which will only be, you know, available on podcasts for a price. So my mother's first novel is called The Tessellated Path. It's very much a woman's point of view in terms of love, desire, sex,
all these things. Interesting. Yeah. Great. Well, look that up. Thank you for listening. You can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or tweet Sharad at SharadKutten. That's his handle. Or, post on our Facebook. We'd love to hear from you always. That's BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. But we hope you've enjoyed this discussion. I am once again Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharad Kutten, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.